Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Happy birthday, 18 months to the Alcohol Free Life podcast for July. I'm focusing on some episodes from the archives, giving you another chance to hear some of the great episodes that we've done over the past 18 months. And as I said before, I'd love to hear some of your favourites. I've been getting some messages in, and I'm trying to gather little edits and bits and pieces from different podcasts. It's really interesting to see such a wide range of guests have inspired people in lots of different ways. It just sometimes takes one thing that a guest says and you just go, wow, I get it. That's exactly how I feel. And it can make so much difference. So I really hope you're enjoying getting a chance to hear some of these again. And make sure you check Instagram at Genuinely Grace, because there's some competitions and some stuff happening there as well. Obviously, if you want to check out the Sober Club, please do. A couple of people messaged me and said, I've heard you mention the Sober Club, but I haven't actually checked it out. Well, go check it out. It's thesoberclub.com. When I first started the podcast, of course, we didn't have the Sober Club, but now we do. And so all of our resources are there. We have the accountability, we have the inspiration, we have amazing experts and guests. So I'd love it if you check it out. Come join us as a member. It's not expensive. It's an incredible way of staying connected, because the opposite of addiction is connection, right? And this week from the archives, I have to bring you Annie Grace, don't I? Another chance to hear the amazing Annie Grace, who has changed so many lives. So enjoy.
I can't tell you how excited I am that my guest is Annie Grace. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us.
Oh, you're such a pleasure.
Busy girl, I know that. Now, where do we start with you? I'm not going to do the official bio, because I think just about anybody listening to this will know what you do. But just tell us your personal story for anyone who hasn't come across that yet. I think most people listening will be well aware of This Naked Mind and possibly the alcohol experiment as well. But just remind us how it all started for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was interesting. I didn't drink a ton growing, like in high school or even college. So I grew up in a household where my dad had quit drinking before I was born, and very spontaneously, he just made a decision one day, but it wasn't even a topic of conversation in our house. And I had this very alternative upbringing, kind of a log cabin, no running water, no electricity on the backside of a mountain. So
nice.
Yeah, very, very strange. But I didn't know it was strange, because it was my life until I went away to college. And then I didn't drink a ton in college. And then I got a master's degree, moved to New York City, newly married. We literally got married, went on our honeymoon, and then got in the car and drove to New York. And I started working at various companies. And I remember one of the first outings was, okay, we're all going out for martinis. And I was like, okay, you know, and I was like trying to find something that would taste okay. And so somebody gave me a Cosmopolitan, and it was pretty good. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And I remember getting the bill for it, and it was like, at that time, it was $25 per drink. And I was like, what is happening? So I was like, this is not fun. And so fast forward like 6 months, I think I got away with, you know, not really going out to the bar happy hour. And then I had switched jobs. I'd gotten promoted. I was the youngest vice president in this multinational company that was actually headquartered in London, but I was in their New York satellite office. And I was taken aside by somebody in the office and said, hey, Annie, why aren't you ever joining us for happy hour, especially when the senior execs from the UK are in town? Mm. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I don't really drink. And they're like, no, it's not about the drinking. It's about the networking. It's about telling, you know, your story and your ideas. And we just don't have time during the day and all this stuff. And so I was like, okay. And so I did, I'm so methodical in hindsight in how I approach things. I said, okay, right, I'm going to have a method, and I don't want to be one of those people dancing on the, you know, table. And like, I've seen all that. That's not me. I'm very serious. I'm very academic. I'm very into my career. So I had a method, and it was a glass of wine and a glass of water, and then a glass of wine and a glass of water. And a few months later, you know, when the pressure to keep up and stay out late would be really intense and my wine water wasn't working, I felt myself getting tipsy. I'd go into the bathroom to throw up the wine, to come back out with some mouthwash in my purse to drink more wine just to keep up. Wow. And so fast forward a decade, and I had been promoted. So I was now in charge of marketing globally for this company, and I was traveling to 22 countries. And I was drinking, you know, well over a bottle, close to two bottles a night for my 5'7", 145 pound frame. It was kind of ridiculous. And really stopped feeling the alcohol. Like it didn't affect me anymore. I didn't feel tipsy. I didn't feel drunk. And so through kind of a series of events, which I'll have to digress a little bit to tell you this part of my story, but I think it's really relevant.
Yeah, definitely.
My youngest son was born, and I was faced with pretty intense postpartum depression, which was a surprise because while I knew I was susceptible to depression, I'd struggled with it a bit in college. I didn't have it with my first son. So I kind of sailed through that and I was like, oh, okay, so that's sorted. You know, all the doctors said, if you had it before, watch for postpartum. But then when my second son was born, I was like, oh, I don't have postpartum, thinking it was isolated, but no, it's per pregnancy. Nobody told me that. So yeah. I was hit really hard with it at 8 to 12 weeks. And that was in combination with a back injury that ended up lasting for years. And I couldn't pick my kids up out of the crib. It was really painful to nurse. It was painful to get on a flight. I was taking medication for my back, muscle relaxant, stuff like that, in combination with a whole cocktail of antidepressants. And meanwhile, really my drinking took off and it became, you know, much, much different relationship with alcohol. It was very much to get through the day, self-medicate. I remember saying, all right, if I can just obliviate, that was kind of my word, yeah, like just yeah. get enough.
Numb out.
And then waking up at 3 a.m. and just feeling the weight of it, you know, all of it rushing in, massive adrenaline, panic, and just being like, oh gosh, how much did I drink last night? And how many promises to myself or my husband had I broken? And actually near the end, going back in the kitchen at 3 a.m. and drinking enough to pass back out. And so it was bad at that point in my life. And at the same time, I had this really serious back pain. And so I was stumbled across this book called Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. And the book posits that actually a lot of, yes, it can start with an injury, but what ends up happening is that your so much drama is going on in your life that your subconscious mind will distract you from thoughts you don't want to think, like, oh, I hate my life, or I hate my kid, or I'm so frustrated that they're still crying, or like all these thoughts that make us bad people become repressed. So our shadow thoughts become repressed. And the body protects us by producing pain because that's a distraction. And so that's the theory of this book. And actually, if you can understand that the pain is coming from the subconscious mind, you can heal the pain. And I was like, yeah, right. I don't believe that. I'm so skeptical. Yeah. Doesn't make any, you know, but I was so desperate. So I read the 300-page book. And I mean, literally by the end of the book, I, you know, within 2 weeks, I was picking up my kids. I was jumping on the trampoline. We moved houses at the time. I was able to help with the moving.
Well, you were still drinking though at this point, were you?
I was still drinking heavily. Drinking. Mm-hmm. But the pain miraculously disappeared. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then I had a moment where I was coming home from London. I had spent the week over there and it was an international team. So it was during Australia Day. So we were celebrating Australia Day in London, which was just the trifecta of the most boozy day.
Can imagine.
I ended up losing my wallet and throwing up in the taxi cab and then having to pay £100 cleaning fee to get my wallet. It was such a disaster. So I'm coming home from this week of just so much drinking and I'm in Heathrow and I'm down kind of in the bowels and I had extra time. And I'd woken up super early and gone to the breakfast at the hotel with a massive hangover. And I'd ordered a mimosa, but they hadn't opened the champagne yet. And so she's like, well, you know, the champagne's not open because it's only 6. People don't come in till 8. She's like, but I can give you a vodka orange juice. And although, yeah, I would be drinking at 3 a.m, like kind of deliriously, I kind of had this line in my head like, oh no, vodka in the morning is one of those things you don't do. I'd separated these. You compartmentalize so much when you're going through this.
Yeah.
So I'd really separated these things. But I was like, okay, but oh, I just feel so bad. So I was like, all right, just give me the vodka and orange juice. And I had, I think, 2 or 3 before getting in the cab to get to the airport. And so I'm getting off the, I'm sitting in the bottom of the, of Heathrow, and I'm just had this moment of like, miraculous that my back didn't hurt, but what about my drinking? And I was like, and I did something really radical at the time that I didn't have any idea was radical. I had been putting so many rules on myself. Like, I'm not going to drink until the weekend. I'm only going to drink 2 glasses of wine, all of these rules. And I just kept breaking and breaking and breaking. And I was like, what if I just got off that cycle altogether? And I tried to understand this, because my idea that just kind of hit me like a bolt of lightning was like, what if most of this is subconscious conditioning? What if my subconscious mind has received this lifetime of messages that alcohol is now key to relaxation? And then I've confirmed it with my own experience. And what if I could undo that? What if I could undo that? Because I knew I wasn't like in the 10% that was going to have delirium tremens, or, you know, if I, because I could stop. I could stop for 9 months every time I had a baby. I could stop for weeks when we went to see our teetotaling, you know, in-laws, you know, like it was definitely much more in my mind, because when I would be stopped, I would still have so much, oh, poor me. I miss it. Things aren't fun. I'm the designated driver. This is crap. Like, I just didn't, have that. I wasn't at peace when I was stopped. And so I said, right, I'm going to stop with the whole cycle of this trying to make promises and breaking the promises. I'm going to stop that. I'm going to drink however much I want, but I'm going to do it mindfully. And at the same time, I'm going to research if this is possible. What is the truth? And so I started with a list of all the reasons I drank, and I just poured it all out. And then I started asking other people, why do you drink? Why do you drink? And I had this huge list of reasons. And then I just started very methodically, like, I have a master's in science. I just started very methodically going back through and saying, right, okay, anxiety. I drink for anxiety. What does the science say? What is really true? Yeah. And over, it was like just all of these reasons just came crashing down. It was such a house of cards. Everything that I thought I was drinking for, alcohol was actually contributing to. It was doing the opposite. Yeah. And, you know, there's so much science behind it. And that's really, this Naked Mind originated not because I wanted to write I call myself an accidental author. Like, I didn't have any intention to quit my job or do any of those sorts of things. But what had happened was it took me about 13 months. It was a very long process, but a very healing and graceful process too, because I really let myself off the hook. You know, I really did.
You were kind to yourself along the way.
Yes. And it was so compassion based and grace based.
Well, that is amazing, because as I'm sure we'll go on to talk about, you know, one of the hardest things is that when people are going through this, often we, you know, we're beating ourselves up for drinking too much. And then when we stop, we're beating ourselves up again for slipping up or for having the wrong thoughts. And it all, as you say, comes back to that. But let me just ask you a couple of things about that story. I mean, what's always fascinating to me is that, you know, bright people with master's degrees, you know, we fall for this. It's just beyond me, actually. Now I look back, I can't get my head around how incredibly ingrained in every bit of our culture it is. You know, you said even, you know, your boss had effectively said, you know, well, if you want to be part of our gang, you know, this is the social glue for our organization. You know, it's just bizarre. But I suppose my question is, why is it that bright people don't understand what alcohol, why don't we all understand what alcohol does to us? I mean, we do now, thank you to your book and many others, but for so many people and for so many years, we've been brainwashed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. It's such a complicated question. I think there's a lot of you know, I've had the opportunity now to speak to people who have stopped drinking through my book, who were big in the alcohol advertising industry.
Oh, really?
And it is, yes. And it's so powerful. And there's actually a video of one woman who I'm going to hope to publish on YouTube sometime soon, because it's just like her story. But they had psychologists on staff, you know, and they go so deep into like human behavior and what's going to trigger and how to create an emotional response and all of these different things. And they very firmly target, you know, stressful careers, you know, and then it's placed in, you know, at the end of a shift, the detectives are going to do something. And so alcohol is subconsciously associated through so much media with success.
Yes.
And our brains, they actually produce a thought error when we're doing something that's different than the group. And that's just a very basic survival mechanism. We evolved as tribal animals, you know, back in the 10,000 years ago, and we're protecting ourselves from the saber-toothed tiger. You know, I know it's cliche, but it's so true. And so when you're doing something different than everybody around you, and then because alcohol does work. So yeah. What I mean by that is that if you're a lawyer or a doctor, two very heavy drinking professions, very intelligent people, and you were very upset, or, you know, I had someone who was an EMT and he would be a first responder on all sorts of accidents. And it's so hard for the psyche to see that and to see what they encounter every single day. I mean, doctors are dealing with death on a daily basis and they need an escape, and alcohol physiologically slows down your brain's ability to think. And so it creates what feels like, I mean, it's numbness. It creates what feels like a peace and a gap in your thoughts, because it is affecting how fast your neurotransmitters connect to each other. And that numbness really reconfirms, oh, it does help with stress. Now, the interesting thing is that numbness lasts for about, you know, the numbness can continue. You can make yourself unconscious by drinking too much. We all know this, but the feeling of kind of that, gap in the thoughts, that's about 20 minutes. And then your body, because alcohol is a depressant, starts to respond and actually releases like adrenaline and cortisol to counteract the depressant. So you actually then chemically add stressors. So it will make you feel numb in the very short term, 20 to 30 minutes, but then it makes you much more physically stressed because of the chemicals that your body produces to really counterbalance the alcohol. And so, but that 20 to 30 minutes that it's working really reconfirms everything that we've been seeing on media, everything that, you know, our friends are doing, and that thought error that happens. And it's a thought error like fight or flight. Like it feels like, oh my gosh, something is wrong and I'm not going to be okay unless I'm behaving like everybody around me. Mm. And so, yeah, that I think that combination of all those factors is really the answer.
Yeah, it really is. You're absolutely right. And the whole community thing, the whole social glue thing is really, really fascinating. I mean, and also I love the way you explain that, you know, alcohol is both it makes you allegedly happy, but it's actually a depressant. You know, it does both. I really loved reading or hearing on one of your podcasts where you were talking about the fact that you actually drank on your own. Just describe that little piece of it all, because this was a sort of scientific test that you did all by yourself. I don't know if I could ever have done that, but I'm incredulous that you did. What an amazing thing to do, to really prove the power of just being on your own and drinking. Just explain that for anyone who hasn't heard you talk about it.
Yeah, so it's kind of was the original alcohol experiment. And it's funny because so many people have taken this and misinterpreted it, right? And taken it and done things that are like, okay, well, I'm drinking every single day, but now I'm going to have an alcohol experiment. So I'm going to go by myself and like have an alcohol experiment. Like that's not what this is. So what this was that I had been alcohol free, very happily, very at peace for about 60, I think, I don't remember exactly, but it was somewhere between 45 and 60 days. So it was a long chunk of time. Mm. And a lot of the thoughts of, you know, the thought error of hanging out with my friends and having them all drink were creeping back in. And I'm like,
maybe I can have one. Did that thought come in?
Not maybe I can have one, because I now understood the science of how having one so continues to make all the other, like, so, but it was a, maybe I made a mountain out of a molehill.
I'm
wrong. How can everybody else, how can I see something that nobody in my peer group sees? Right. How is that even possible? That doesn't make sense. And so there was like this question. I was like, okay, you know what I can do is I can go into this with total curiosity and prove it to myself. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I set up my iPhone on a tripod and I got myself a bottle. I got myself two bottles of wine because that used to be my tolerance. I only was able to make it through most of one bottle before I started to get really ill. And I just like sat in front of the camera and drank the wine and recorded myself. And I couldn't watch those recordings for 4 years. I mean, it was, I just knew when you go into it so consciously and I described all the feelings. I was like, okay, now it feels like the room kind of is a bit fuzzy around the edges. Like I feel,
I mean, at the beginning, I'm guessing you probably looked happy for a bit, did you?
Yes.
Before it went bad.
Yes. And I have a video if in the alcohol experiment, like the online platform, there's a video on day 28 of I edited down like the 4 hours to about 15 minutes. And yeah, at the beginning, I'm just there, I'm making jokes. I'm like, here it is. And near the end, and it was so painful for me. That's the only reason I watched these videos, was to edit that. And it was so painful for me to look at that and be like, oh my gosh, that's how I look. That's where my sense of humor went. Then I turned grumpy. I was yelling at my dogs. I was like, it was crazy. And I was like, oh, that's the truth. There it is right there. And I'm really glad I did it, because not only did it, I mean, for me, then after that, anytime I think about having any drink, I was like, well, I know what that does. Like, it was so definitive for me and so powerful. And a lot of people, some people do it and try it. A lot of people, again, get it messed up. They're like, okay, I'm going to do it tonight. And I'm like, well, if you've been drinking, like, alcohol feels good when you've been drinking alcohol, because alcohol creates a need for alcohol, right? And then when you're free and you've healed from that, it's a very different situation. It doesn't feel as good. It's like your first drink when you had a few drinks and you're like, oh, I just kind of feel dizzy. You know, it's a very different situation.
Yeah.
But then I do think a lot of people will just watch the video and they're like, oh, all right. Like, I don't, I don't need to do that.
No, I get that completely. And so for you then, I mean, was it ever an option to go down a, you know, what, certainly in the UK, we've got kind of, for a long time, we're brainwashed into thinking, well, there's just the two types of drinkers. You know, there's those completely at rock bottom, and I think there's AA for them. And then there's absolutely everybody else who are perfectly okay. And which is why there's been such an issue with all of us who are in the middle, you know, the gray area drinkers. But for you then, was it ever an option to go to AA or be part of the conventional route? Or did you always think, no, do you know what? I'm going to research this myself and do it differently.
I didn't have the thought that I'm going to research and do it differently, but I also didn't have, I mean, if you would look at it, just, I couldn't even find time to go to the gym. You know, I had two little kids and a crazy job, and I was traveling internationally all the time. I couldn't even find time to shower some days. Like, it was the idea of finding 90 meetings in 90 days. And it was just an impossibility. There wasn't even a chance that was going to be an option for me. And I don't think I put a lot of conscious thought into, like, no, I'm against that. It's not an option for me. I'm not going to go into it wasn't conscious. It just wasn't an option. Mm. Plus, I had a really strange experience with a good friend of mine who had stopped drinking through AA. And I asked her when she stopped, probably about 6 years before I did, I asked her, I was like, well, hey, we drink together all the time. And she's like, no, Annie, I've learned that I was born an alcoholic. I'm different. And so I also had that buried in the back of my mind, like, oh, okay, so I'm not. So again, just wasn't an option for me, because it is very much like, oh no, there's alcoholic drinkers and then there's not alcoholic drinkers. And, you know, they almost have like spidey sense, like they can tell who's who. And it was like, no, you're not one, you know, I'm the person who does this and you don't and stuff. And so she had sort of this criteria, and I was like, all right, well, I guess that's not me. And you know, according to the Center for Disease Control, only 10% of excessive drinkers are actually clinically dependent on alcohol. Yeah. Like 90% are not. So that gray area is huge. You know, it's most people, to be
exactly
fair, most drinkers. And my passion is really to, in any way I can, help facilitate the question around drinking becoming a wellness conversation and a health conversation, not an addiction conversation. We're doing ourselves such a disservice that we can't talk about it like we can talk about sugar or carbs or, you know, anything else wellness related.
Yeah, absolutely. And what have been the, I'm sure that we could carry this conversation on forever in a day, but what have been the kind of the, what were the first benefits you saw? I mean, I'm sure there's been many, and what's amazing is that, you know, year on year, there's still more, but I find there's still more coming, you know, which is great. But in the early stages, what did you notice? For me, I noticed the anxiety disappear. And interestingly, I didn't even know that I hadn't realized how anxious I even was until some of it dissipated. That for me was absolutely massive. What were the gifts it gave you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I did lose like 13 pounds in the first 30
days. Oh, did you? Oh, lucky you. I didn't. I see. I'm one of the people who hardly lost any weight. I was really hoping to lose a couple of stone within a week, but sadly not. But well done you then.
Well, it was interesting too, because how I was drinking, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was like drinking most of my calories. So yeah. My body wasn't being like
nourished
at all. Yeah. Really? And so my whole relationship with food changed in a much better and more positive way. That was really good. And then also, like, just people started just commenting on my skin. I've always struggled with acne, and like my skin started looking so much better and clearer. And my eyes, I had someone just last week, they're like, your eyes, it's like you're almost always on the verge of tears. They're so like shiny. And I'm like, I don't drink. Like, that's why, you know?
Wow.
And I think one of the biggest ones, though, to echo you, is, you know, all of that cocktail of antidepressants. I was on four different drugs. So,
Oh my goodness, you're actually on antidepressants. I hadn't realized that.
Yes. So, and I do give them a lot of credit for giving me the space, you know, to get to a place where I could stop drinking.
Yeah.
But about a year into it, I started realizing that, wow, these are making me feel numb. Now that I feel so much better, I'm actually noticing the numbing effect and the you know, homogenizing effect of these drugs. And so I worked with my doctor, and it took about a year, and I got off all of my medication.
Wow.
By choice. Like, and it was great. So I was taking like a sleeping pill, two different antidepressants, and an anti-anxiety pill. And I don't take any of those anymore.
Amazing.
And it was really, that's definitely the biggest one.
And I mean, I'm guessing, you know, with the millions of people you've helped with your work, with your book, with your books and your programs, you must have heard so many amazing stories of people whose, you know, various ailments have got better. I mean, I don't think there's anything that stopping drinking doesn't help with, as it were. It helps with everything. Yeah, amazing.
On and on and on. It's amazing. I mean, one of the biggest ones for people is sleeping too,
because it's
not in the short term. It's in
at the beginning, it can be tricky, can't it?
Yeah, because we're actually using alcohol to turn off our brain. But what happens is, because we're turning off our brain with a chemical, our brain actually springs right back to life. And so we wake up during the middle of the night. And so you're getting, there's a chapter in William Porter's book, Alcohol Explained, that really goes into detail on how you actually aren't doing any of the most deeply restful sleep at all when you're drinking regularly. And so just that, like the sleep, the knock-on effect of actually getting this type of sleep you need in your life is massive.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I know you know, your book is fantastically kind of, This Naked Mind is very logical. It's you're really describing the logic of it. And I think that's what sometimes people love that, to read the kind of the science of it all. And I know that my question is, who inspired you? I know that you reference, Alan Carr in the book, I think you do, and I know you referenced Jason Vail, who's a really good friend of mine. Were you doing a wide range of kind of reading yourself for all of this inspiration and research?
It was really interesting. So I had done so much research and really written the majority of the book before I read Alan Carr and Jason Vail's books.
Oh, really?
But then a friend of mine who's British, he's like, oh my gosh, he was reading just the early draft. He's like, this is so similar and you need to read this. And this is so good. And then I ended up like throwing in lots of their quotes to places where they said things better than I said. The pitcher plant, like Alan Carr describes that phenomenally. Yeah. So I was like, you know, put that in there because it's just such a phenomenal thing. So I think that their work is, you know, amazing and so good. And I would also say that Dr. John Sarno, with the back pain book, a lot of the methodology came from that. There was a book called A Man Called Dave Gray, which is liminal thinking. And that was just kind of this idea of the subliminal and the liminal point and how to actually uncover some of your subconscious. That was really influential. And one of the most influential was Thad A. Polk from the University of Michigan. He has done a course called The Addictive Brain. And it was phenomenal. It really explained so much of the science behind it. And I actually ended up being in touch with him after, you know, after it was out and stuff. And so that was incredible. I think that some people, you know, to a lesser extent, but still really kind of thought leaders, but not specifically around alcohol or addiction, like Charles Duhigg with the Habit Loop And he talks about the power of habit. Like, that was so fascinating to me. And Malcolm Gladwell, is so interesting because Malcolm Gladwell just has gone on Oprah with his book that he just came out with and really talking about the alcohol culture. And he's one of the first people of that level of fame to really be describing some of the science behind. He's talking specifically about this idea that alcohol, we think it loosens up our inhibitions, but actually chemically it does not do that. And he explains what exactly it does, and it's phenomenal, but he was really influential as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how things are changing. What do you think will happen in the next, I don't know, somebody asked me actually, if I could make a prediction, you know, what will happen in 10 years time? You know, we read that millennials are drinking less. We know that there is a trend towards, you know, mindful drinking and people ditching the booze. But it is still illegal, of course, and it is still the number one most harmful drug when you take everything into account. So what do you think will happen in the next sort of 10 years?
Well, I mean, my hope is that our cultural bias for alcohol would change to at least be neutral, if not similar to smoking and slightly like against alcohol. I don't think it's reasonable to think that things would become, I mean, we've tried prohibition in the States. It didn't work. Right. And I actually don't believe that, you know, doing things like making it a legal or government issue is going to serve us. I think we really have to move beyond that and make an individual mindful, well-educated, decision, because when things are forced on us, they're never true to us. And I don't think we'll obliterate alcohol. I mean, we haven't obliterated smoking, but I do think you can have such a shift. Like if we could have a world where it was as normal not to drink as it is to drink,
exactly.
And it was completely, nobody's giving you a side eye. Nobody's wondering if you're pregnant. I remember when I first said, I'm not drinking, I literally got grilled. Are you pregnant? Are you on medication? What's happening? What's going on? Where's my drinking buddy? This is not fair. How, like, it was so intense, you know, and you have to have, it's like alcohol. You have to justify not doing it. Right.
Exactly.
And if we could just move past that, evolve past that to where it can be a mindful decision that's individual and there's no judgment either way.
Yeah, I think
exactly. That would be beautiful.
That would be great. Do you, one interesting question I have for you. Do you feel that everyone has, because I sometimes say that, you know, for me, it's not an option to moderate. I couldn't become a mindful drinker because I don't have an off switch. You know, I can't have one. It'll turn into many. Some people we know do manage to moderate successfully. They don't have the same issues. Do you think that all of us have a propensity, if you like, to tip into drinking too much, depending on circumstances?
Yeah, so I can answer that in a few ways. There was a study done where they force-fed mice, right? And mice are a great example of humans. We're so different, but we're very similar genetically. And they, first of all, they had to force-feed it because it was not something that they would voluntarily drink. And that just says everything, right? Mm. But then once they were force-fed, they all did become addicted because physiologically alcohol is addictive. Now, I think that because it makes us feel so badly, we can very much, you know, think in ways that mice don't think. Like, I'm going to only have a few. I'm not going to do it all the time. If you were to just chemically drink a six pack every night for a year, I think, yes, human beings with blood, flesh, and bone would become addicted. I think that we prevent ourselves from doing that with various reasoning and logic and saying, okay, this doesn't feel good. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to drink tonight, whatever the case is. I do think, however, there is a really strong correlation, and this has been researched extensively, between the moment that you start drinking to self-medicate and that flip in your brain, because something very different happens when you're drinking to self-medicate. Your brain sees it in a different way. It becomes much more of an evolutionary, I need this thing into food and water, which is what they saw with the mice, which of course those mice, they're in a cage. They're being force-fed alcohol. They're undergoing, you know, some level of trauma. They're not like having a happy life. And so all of them became addicted. Now in our situation, most people I speak to, there was a moment where it changed, where it changed from being relatively in control, maybe a few times out of control, to, oh my gosh, totally out of control. Now, for me, it was that postpartum depression with my second son. Mm-hmm. For my good friend, Jolene Park, it was her divorce. Yeah. And so it's always like, usually people can trace it back to something, or they can't trace it back to something, but they're like, yeah, I did start drinking for stress. I really started to drink to relieve stress. And in our society, I mean, how common is that?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly.
Probably the number one reason people give. So yeah, are we all at risk because of that? Yes. And if you were drinking to self-medicate, that is, I would say, the danger zone.
That really makes sense. And this one final kind of question then. One of the things is, you touched on it a little bit when you first give up and the questions everyone else asks you, the sober shaming, that we all know about. What would be your top tip for anyone who's in those early stages of how you respond to these ridiculous comments that other people throw at you?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what not to do, because I did it. And that is try to posture and evangelize and get into an argument. Because I mean, to be honest with you, like, people are doing that. And my top tip is really to understand the motivation behind it. And now, after, helping so many people and hearing so many stories, the motivation behind that is fear. It's a fear of their own drinking, because you're putting a mirror up.
Shining a light on them, aren't you?
Shining a light on them. So like, there's some level of discomfort with their own drinking, or it's a fear of losing you and how things used to be. They don't know.
Losing their drinking buddy. Yeah.
Look like. And so it's based in fear. And if you can really come in and understand that and be like, oh, totally cool. What do you want? Let me get you a beer. I used to do that with my husband. He doesn't drink anymore, but he drank for probably a year and a half after I stopped. And I would be like, what do you want? I'm going to go get him. And I'd always order him a drink. So like, I would put it in his hand. So he never felt, I was never going to be sitting there like, because I knew if he made a decision for me, it wouldn't be a decision that was his own. It wouldn't stick. There would be resentment in it. He'd be pleasing me. And it's just not fair. And so just really almost going over the top to say, okay, it's fear. And how can I be of service in this relationship? Should you care about the relationship? If you don't care, just tell them to screw off. And whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You do care and you want to continue the relationship. How can you be of service and help alleviate the fear? And I think without falling on your own sword, because I went from evangelizing to like, oh no, it was just me. I was the one with the problem. And then I'd leave and they'd feel fine, but then I'd feel like crap. I'd be like, oh, that wasn't really true. I think everybody has, and so it's kind of in that place of just showing up. And the beauty is that when you push through it and you just show up and you don't have to say anything, the ripple effect of you being present, not drinking, everybody else starts to be like, that's possible.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then their guard is down. Whereas if you're going to try to tell them that drinking is wrong, or how, this is what I did, it causes cancer. Do you know this about alcohol? Oh my gosh. And I'd like really go in hard trying to change people's opinions. Nobody changed. But when I changed that and I really went in with like, I'm just here. You're here. I'm here. Let's have a conversation.
Yeah. And I heard one of your podcasts where you gave such a simple suggestion, and I love it, where somebody, I think, asked you, what shall I say? I just don't know what to say. And you gave a really good suggestion. And that was, when you arrive at the bar or whatever, and someone says, oh, would you like a drink? And instead of going into a complete, well, actually, I'm not, because, and then this and then that, you just go, I'd love a drink. Thank you very much. Can I have a sparkling water? since when did the word drink mean alcohol? It's bizarre, isn't it? But that's a great tip. So, don't make a big deal out of it. What's really quite interesting is after the first little bit of the conversation, most people don't notice that they're off doing their drinking and they don't notice whether you are or you aren't.
Absolutely. And it's so much easier to say yes than no. Just the human beings, again, it's that thought error. If you can say yes to somebody, it feels nice. So.
Yeah. Definitely. Annie, we could talk for absolutely hours, and I so appreciate the work you're doing. You must be just a little bit kind of amazed yourself. As you say, you're an accidental author, and here you are. You've built an empire, and it's amazing because you're changing the conversation around drinking, really. And I guess that's your main passion, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I am blown away every day. It's such an honor to be able to do this.
So just tell us where people can find more about you and obviously the alcohol experiment. Just tell us exactly what that consists of.
So it's a free online 30-day challenge. So you sign up at alcoholexperiment.com and you just plug in your start date whenever you want to start, and then it drip feeds you a daily video and email from me, just some motivation, and you just can like dip a toe. There's no predetermined outcome at the end of it. Like I provide lots of information about what moderation looks like if you want to go that route, what, you know, maybe going forward, continuing alcohol free if you feel so good. The stats about that are amazing. Like 93% of people said they were much happier after just a 4-week break from alcohol. So it's just really an experiment, a way to say, oh, okay. And even if you drink during it, it's a data point, right? It's like, oh, okay, I did. And I'm becoming mindful. And I think that's it, is just like really putting, shining the light of your consciousness on this behavior that's been really unconscious.
I think that's so true, because I think it can be really difficult for people to talk about forever, you know, to make that decision. Oh, I'm going to give up drinking forever. It feels just way too big. So as you
and I
say,
like how Alan Carr said it. He said, you're not going to know you're successful till you're dead if you do.
Yeah, dead right. Annie, thank you so much. Just give us your website, please.
Thisnakedmind.com.
Right. Thank you. I so appreciate it. It's been amazing to talk to you.
Same. Thank you.
From the archives, Annie Grace on the Alcohol Free Life podcast, which we're doing these archive episodes because we're 18 months old this month. And I'm 2.5 years sober. So I just sort of pat myself on the back there. So thank you so much for listening. Check out thesoberclub.com if you want inspiration and connection and community. And we focus very much on health and well-being. And carry on. Let me know your fave podcasts over the last 18 months. And check out the competitions as well, because we've got some good, cool stuff to give away. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.